Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer, WNYC. A couple of follow-ups. Real quick, back to the story on the fireman's test and the discrimination that the court found against African-American applicants in New York City from the top of our show today. Many of you have asked for examples of the questions on the test, and we just posted the 1999 and 2002 FDNY exams that we were able to dig up that were entered as evidence in this lawsuit. So that's on our webpage if you want to see it at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Also, earlier this week, we talked about the loudest places in New York City and took your nominations. Well, we've now mapped your suggestions from the corner of Metropolitan and Bushwick Avenues in Williamsburg to the helicopter pad on the west side of Manhattan. Check out the Loud City map on our show page at WNYC.org and add your own loud spot if you want. Now, Google's threat to leave China is not the first effort by the giant search engine to push back against Chinese government censorship. A new book by Columbia University President Lee Bollinger reminds us that in 2007, Google appealed to the United States Trade Representative, arguing that Chinese censorship was the number one barrier to trade between the two nations and violated free trade agreements. No action from the U.S. Trade Representative, as of when Bollinger's book went to press. But he says the European Parliament has recently launched an initiative to treat internet censorship as a barrier to trade. So let's begin there to discuss Lee Bollinger's new book about freedom of the press in a globalized world. The book, Uninhibited, Robust, and Wide Open, A Free Press for a New Century, published by the Oxford University Press. Before his career as a university president, if you didn't know this, Lee Bollinger was a free speech lawyer and scholar. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much, Brian.
Does this argument hold water? Can internet censorship be considered a barrier to free trade in the way that a tariff might be?
Well, I think I think we have to start with what's happened in the last 10 years. And the most important thing is the growth of free markets. So it's globalization is primarily a business and financial world. We see that with the financial meltdown. I mean, that is not a U.S. phenomena. That is a global phenomena. It's because of the interconnectedness. And so we've established this relationship now with China that's very deep and significant economically. And we want China to succeed as a country, to be a leader among nations. But to have that happen, we really also have to have the civic institutions for the world, including a free and independent press. So you have to think of tools to accomplish that. And one of them is the trade policy and law that has been set up over the past 20, 30 years.
And you write that just as the U.S. has come to embrace labor and environment standards in its free trade negotiations around the world, so too should it incorporate the values of freedom of speech and of the press. But make the case. I mean, labor and environmental standards get degraded specifically because of free trade, because there's a race to the bottom. So those safeguards are very necessary, very relevant. Does free trade inhibit freedom of the press, or do you just want them linked for leverage?
Right. So I think the answer to that, Brian, is you cannot have the interdependency that comes with free trade unless you also have the information that will make it possible to have a sustained relationship over time that's beneficial to everyone. So, and we can't count, I think, on free markets alone to produce that. We can't count on the internet alone. I mean, that's one of the things Google shows, this most recent episode, is that we need more efforts to try to get a free flow of information.
Another novel argument in your book is that censorship of the press by other countries limits the rights of Americans, not just people right there. How do you come to that conclusion?
I come to that conclusion, and by the way, I'm very appreciative of how deeply you've read the book. You come to that conclusion because, again, one goes back to what's happening in the world today. Just in the past 10 to 20 years, the remarkable alignment of the world economies around principles of free trade and capitalism has produced this incredible interdependency and integration. And we want that to blossom and flower because there are all kinds of benefits that come from it. But in order for that to happen, there really has to be more free flow of information.
And I love the argument because it interprets the right to a free press not just from the media's perspective, not just from the free speaker's perspective, but from the news consumer's perspective,
right.
Right to be exposed to a free press. So I wonder, though, since you've done First Amendment law, has our First Amendment ever been interpreted in that way?
Yes, it has. And it's very important, I think, to understand that freedom of the press as we know it today in this country is really a product of the last century. The very first case that I teach when I teach my First Amendment courses I do every year is in 1919. There is no Supreme Court case on freedom of the press or free speech before 1919. All through the 20th century, we struggled to get rid of our own restrictions on freedom of the press, on state secrets, on free press, fair trial, on libel. And we created this wonderful, very vibrant, the most vigorous in the world, system of a free press in this country. We did it from a local kind of world to a national, and now we have to do it on a global.
One of the interesting things about the Google threat to leave China is that we see the intersection in the new media world between the journalistic and the personal. Here is a person in China through a translator on Morning Edition today describing being digitally snooped on.
Yes.
I saved this research plan in my mailbox, and I didn't tell anyone about it. But when the police came to talk to me, they mentioned this plan. This shows they know clearly what's in my mailbox, even draft documents.
So that's a creepy story. Imagine if the government was snooping around in your inbox, everyone. But it means Google was willing to live with some censorship of its news searches, but is drawing the line at the government messing with Gmail accounts in that way. So in the new media world, the right to privacy may leverage the right to a free press.
Right. I think, I mean, this is extremely important that we have a balanced perspective about what's going on. And let me just make a couple of points. I was in Beijing last March. I walked towards the Forbidden City. There are a number of press kiosks. If you ask for the International Herald Tribune or Newsweek or Time, they don't sell it. It's not available. If you go back to the hotel and it's a 3-star hotel or above, you can get those magazines. You can get CNN and so on. There are ways in China now to get information. China is opening up to a certain extent, and we want to try to foster that. This is extremely important to the future of the world. The second point, very quickly, is that we have to remember that we did not have a perfect commitment to freedom of the press and free speech in this country in the last century. We had sedition laws. We had restrictions on speech that hurt the reputation of public officials. It took us a century to get there.
And there are still pressures against free journalistic speech, market pressures
among
them.
That's right. Yes, indeed. Very hard to get information for the press, certain government activities. During the Iraq War, there were very serious concerns raised by the press about lack of access.
Columbia University President Lee Bollinger here talking about ideas in his new book, Uninhibited, Robust, and Wide Open, A Free Press for a New Century. I want to stay on China for just a minute because, interestingly, here is a China free speech advocate through a translator, again, on Morning Edition today, worried that if Google does actually depart, that that would harm free speech.
Yes.
If they really cared about information freedom, they'd stay in China and resist the Chinese government. The biggest beneficiary of Google's move is the Chinese government, and the biggest victims will be us netizens.
So, Lee Bollinger, have you developed an opinion on the relative benefit or harm to free speech or a free press in China by Google staying or leaving to stand on principle?
With respect to Google, I just don't know enough about what's happening, in fact. But I think this is one of our big dilemmas, but it is always a dilemma. That is, how much do we engage and remain engaged in order to help a society develop as we think it should, understanding that that has to be a dialogue, and to what extent do we stand on principle and leave and disengage? My own sense is that in this case, I'm not speaking now about Google. But it's incredibly important that we stay and remain engaged with China.
You tell a great story in your book about Peru under Fujimori, who tried to destroy a free press by literally buying 9 of the 10 television stations, all the big ones, leaving only one little one in private hands. Do you remember that story?
It is indeed. It is from another book, another author. A book's called The Bottom Billion, and he makes the point that if you want to help deal with poverty and disease, as well as corruption in other societies, one of the most important things you can do is have a free press. And I try to use it to make the point that a free press as an institution for the modern global society is really, to use the language of the UN, a touchstone for all the other rights that we think are important.
And that seems to be very relevant to the internet age, because you can have one little website, some lone cranky blogger out there who digs up some damning fact, and in a day, all the big global news organizations can pick it up, and it's having an impact.
And so this is part of the enormous change that it gives us so much opportunity for more information. The internet and satellites are really now the infrastructure for a global free speech, free press. On the other hand, we have to recognize that media organizations, our major ones, are contracting their coverage of foreign affairs. So we're getting more in the way of the cranky website and less in the way of the bureau in Afghanistan reporting on what's happening.
And it cycles back to exactly why restrictions on freedom of the press placed by other countries harm America's right to a freedom to freedom of the press, to consume news, because the big U.S. news organizations aren't as big as they used to be.
That's right.
And aren't staffing foreign countries the way they used to. So we have to depend on those countries in order to get information out, their own journalists.
That's right. It is no longer, I try to say in the book, a matter of human rights around the world. We have our system, and we should help other people have their. It's now what happens there is as relevant to us as what happens in California.
So last question. As a First Amendment legal scholar, you say that the law in this country will continue to evolve on freedom of the press for the global era. What kind of case, because the book has history of the Supreme Court intervening over time to help facilitate a free press in the modern sense, what kind of case can you envision making it to the Supreme Court in coming years?
Involving global free press kind of issues. You could imagine several, but one would be, reporters are unable to cover the war in Afghanistan or in Yemen, and they need the access that the government, U.S. government, can provide. Should the First Amendment, in the interest of informing the public, require the government to give reporters access to what's happening in war zones? Classic example.
Lee Bollinger, president of Columbia University, also the author now of Uninhibited, Robust, and Wide Open, A Free Press for a New Century, published by the Oxford University Press. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
By the way, do you happen to know Ted Olson?
I do.
The conservative lawyer who often argues before the Supreme Court. Well, he's arguing in court in California now for same-sex marriage as a civil right.
Yes, indeed.
And we will talk about why in a minute. Stay with us.